Now, you have been given the notation about protective work in the Infinite Way Letters 1955 and the new one that will be in the Infinite Way Letter June 1960. And you have been given the notation of the writings on the subject of treatment, which are embodied in the Infinite Way Letters June, September, October, November 1959. And the notation when working on problems of human relationships, the chapter Relationship of Oneness in the Art of Spiritual Healing, and the chapter Love Thy Neighbor in Practicing the Presence. And it is necessary that you work faithfully for many, many months. And it doesn't make any difference if you work with these for a year or two, until these principles are so much a part of your being that it becomes automatic for you to feel rather than to remember or state. Now let me illustrate this. In the period when you are learning how to give treatments correctly, how to do healing work correctly, when you are studying the principles of the Infinite Way. And remember this, it makes no difference what your metaphysical background is. Your principles of healing are not those of the Infinite Way. These healing principles that are given in the Infinite Way have revealed themselves to me during the years of my active healing ministry, and it is only because they differ from the known metaphysical teachings of today that there is an Infinite Way. In other words, if these were the same principles that were taught in Christian Science or Unity, there would be no need for Infinite Way books or Infinite Way students or Infinite Way tapes. It is only because principles have revealed themselves to me which have not heretofore been in use in practice in the other metaphysical teachings that I stepped out of the organization with which I worked and have been given this work in the message of the Infinite Way. Now, these principles must first of all be known by you, then they must be practiced by you. In other words, there isn't anyone in this room that doesn't have a friend or a relative or a neighbor suffering from some form of human problem. Therefore, there isn't anyone in this room that hasn't occasion every day of the week to give some treatments. Now, the degree of help that you're going to give is dependent upon the truth that is embodied in your treatments. No healing is going to be any better than the treatment you give. No outer expression of harmony can be any greater than the degree of truth that enters into the demonstration. In other words, the truth that is embodied in your treatment becomes the very substance and essence of the healing. I could explain it to you from a higher standpoint. And for this example, we will use Jesus Christ. When you turned 2,000 years ago to Jesus Christ, more than likely you received an instantaneous or very quick healing. Now, what did that? His consciousness of truth became the law unto your body or business or whatever it was he was treating, weather even. His consciousness of truth became the law unto your experience. Now, had you gone to one of the disciples, you may also have had a healing. It may have been slower, but probably eventually it would have taken place. And the reason is that the disciples' state of consciousness, the disciples' consciousness of truth, became the law unto you and your experience. But because their consciousness of truth wasn't as high as the Master's, the healing probably was not as great or instantaneous or miraculous. That same thing applies in this day and age. If you find one of the practitioners, and there are quite a few of them to be found, if you find one of the practitioners with a highly developed consciousness of truth, a highly evolved spiritual consciousness, you will have marvelous healings. If you find a practitioner not quite so developed, your healings will lack that spontaneity or instantaneity or degree. And so on down the line until you find the practitioner who has taken a course and knows the words and nothing else. And you may have absolutely no result from that practitioner's work. And yet the practitioner is working with the same principles that the others are working who are capable of great healings. And what is the difference? The difference is in the degree of realized truth consciousness. Therefore, a practitioner in the work 5, 6, 7, or 10 years should really be doing a wonderful, wonderful work, which you could not expect and have no right to expect of the practitioner in their first year. Why? Because by the 5th, 6th, 7th, or 10th year, the practitioner has worked with these principles day after day after day after day and night and day and night and day, probably 10, 20, 30 times, probably eventually with 40, 50, 60 patients in a day, until their whole consciousness is so imbued with truth that there is little of humanhood left in them. What do we mean by little of humanhood left in them? Little of fear. That's all there is to humanhood, is fear of that second power, which is evil. That's all there is to humanhood, is our fear. When one becomes imbued with truth, the truth that they become imbued with is God. God, omnipresence. God, Emmanuel. Where I am, God is the only presence, the only power. And when you live with that principle long enough, it becomes the very life of your mind. It becomes the very soul of your being. And you brush aside these evidences or manifestations of sin, disease, lack, limitation, and death in the same way that an experienced desert traveler brushes aside the picture of the mirage, the image, the illusion. In other words, your practitioner who has practiced over a length of time with enough cases and enough different types of cases comes to realize that the words they used in treatment in the first year are really true. When they were using them in treatments in the first year, they didn't know it and didn't believe it. They were merely declaring it. But by the fifth year, they know it now, and there's no longer any need to declare it. No longer any need to voice it, because the very moment a patient flashes their troubles into the consciousness of the practitioner, he immediately recognizes it as mirage, illusion, maya, a claim of two powers, and it's thereby dissolved. There was no mental effort on the part of the practitioner. You will never know how many times our students have said to me as they went in the practice, you know, sometimes I feel ashamed to take their money. I'm not doing enough. They really do. Because there is no mental effort in the healing work. There is no effort at all. The effort comes in the earlier years of developing your consciousness to the point where you actually experience that God is life. That the very nature of God is the life of your patient, or that your patient has no other life but God, no other mind, no other soul, no other being. And this appearance that they have brought to you is a shadow, an image in mind, a belief. And actually, it has its source in the Adamic belief that there are two powers, good power and evil power. Now, in our practice, if you will follow carefully the notations of these special writings that I've given you, you will observe that we never give a treatment to a patient. We couldn't be paid to give a treatment to a patient. We don't take the name of the patient in our thought. We don't care what the nature of the problem is, because we don't take that into our consideration. There is nothing about the patient that ever is permitted to enter our thought. In other words, we don't even try to remember their name or what part of the country they're from. They have presented themselves to us as a patient, and we dismiss it. Why? Well, I've told you, the very first revelation that was given to me was that the metaphysical belief that it's your resentment that causes rheumatism or your hate that causes cancer, it was revealed to me that this is all wrong. The source of man's sins and diseases is the carnal mind, and the, or mortal mind, if you want that term. And this carnal or mortal mind is not a mind. It is a universal belief in a selfhood apart from God, a universal belief in two powers. Therefore, the very moment a claim is presented to us, we recognize it as not a person. Not a person. But a mesmeric picture of a selfhood apart from God, or a law apart from God, or a life apart from God, or a universal belief in two powers. In other words, we impersonalize it. Now that is where our practice differs from every form of metaphysical treatment. We impersonalize by never treating the person, never treating the claim, never under any circumstances holding the individual responsible for whatever it is that is troubling them. We recognize it, the discord, the inharmony, as having its cause in the universal belief of two powers, a universal belief which down through the ages has become mesmeric, so that to some extent we are all victims of the belief in two powers. Now, we begin to shed the results of that belief in proportion as we recognize that evil is not personal. It is impersonal. It has its rise in this universal thing called mortal mind or carnal mind, which isn't a mind and which isn't enmity against God. It's an illusion. It has no law of God to sustain it. It has no ordination from God. It has no basis in God. And since God is the only law, the only cause, the only creative principle, then this can exist only in the same way that the mirage exists on the desert, or that the railroad tracks exist coming together in the distance. They exist only as a false sense of that which is perceived. Now, in these first years, you must work definitely, specifically, and often with these principles. Don't fancy that you are advanced. Don't fancy that you are an advanced metaphysician or an advanced infinite way student. Don't accept such a thing because you have been through a class of advanced healing work. Oh no. You were given this advanced course in the healing work to practice, to study, to work with until you become advanced. I don't know when it is you'll ever become advanced because I haven't reached there yet, but some of you will. And some of you will in belief anyhow. But try not to be fooled by it. There isn't anybody advanced enough yet to call themselves advanced. Be willing to work with these principles religiously until you definitely prove that they are truth and that practicing with them does result in fruitage. Then, as you continue practicing with them, you will find that after 2 or 3 or 4 years of working faithfully day and night with them, that you are consciously declaring them less and less. In other words, you are now getting to where the mathematician gets. At first, when 12 times 12 are presented to him, he has to go through the routine of 2 times 2 are 4, and 2 times 2 are 2 times 1 are 2, 1 times 2 is 2, and 1 times 1 is 1, and add them up, and now we've got 144. But remember that within 2 or 3 years, when the teacher says, how much is 12 times 12, he's supposed to say 144, without thinking it through. So it is. If you work with these principles faithfully, the day will come when, regardless of the name or nature of a claim that is presented to you, you will just automatically realize, shrug your shoulders and walk away. You will about 80% of the time, sometimes 90. There seems to remain 10 or 20% of the time when it is necessary to go further and go back and sit down and go through some of this routine. In other words, some of the problems sometimes that present themselves to us continue to maintain the appearance of reality in spite of our recognition of its unreality. And in this case, it means that we have to sit down and work with these principles until we elevate ourselves so high in consciousness that the spirit of truth takes over. Now, actually, that is what is happening in this healing work. Don't ever think that your treatment heals anybody. Because if you do, you'll get lots of guilt complexes and feel that perhaps you didn't give the right treatment or enough treatment. It isn't your treatment that heals them. Your treatment elevates you above the fear of the picture that is presenting itself to you. That's what your treatment does. It doesn't act on your patient because it isn't directed at your patient. As a matter of fact, you'll find that if you're active in the practice, that probably half of the time you won't know who your patient is. That happens it's happening all the time, every single day, in the form of calls, telephone calls, cables. You don't know who they come from, and they come from the most weird places in the world. And if you wanted to, you wouldn't know how to direct your thought to them, but you don't want to. The purpose of your treatment is not treating your patient. It is assuring and reassuring yourself as to these principles until you are so elevated that you now can settle down and say, Father, it's your turn. Speak, Lord, thy servant heareth, and then you wait. And sometimes seconds, sometimes minutes, you feel this presence within you. You feel a response. You feel a deep breath, or you feel a release, or you may even receive a message. And then you know that God is on the field. It isn't your treatment that brings God on the field. Your treatment elevates you in consciousness to where you can be receptive to the presence of God, which was already there, but which you could not receive through the human mind. Always remember, you cannot reach God through your mind. That is why the prayers that are uttered in churches are really worthless. They have no effect on either God or man. That's why these tens of millions of prayers have been voiced for peace during the three wars. Peace didn't come till the enemy got licked. That is why your ministers are praying in the Orthodox churches for their parishioners. They're praying for them to get well, and then calling upon all the medical aid there is in the history of the world. Why? They know their prayers aren't going to make anyone well. Now then, except, of course, in a rare case where there is a minister who has risen above his ministry and really attained God awareness. But otherwise, these prayers are, well, as a matter of fact, they're not only not beneficial, they're harmful. They give people the belief that there's a God somewhere going to answer them. And it just takes so many lifetimes for people to get pretty discouraged and lose faith in their God and in their church and in religion. And you know that it's happened to too many people in the world. They've just lost faith. And the amount of people that turn out and go to church are not going there because of their faith. They're going there because of their fears of what's going on in the world. Give them a peace for a few years, and the churches would go back to half and quarter occupancy. It's only fear that drives people to church, except those people who, through this metaphysical ministry of the past 90 years, have come to see that there is a form of prayer that does result in the practical Christianity. That is, Christ, the Word made flesh that dwells among us. The Christ that appears as harmony of body, of business, of human relationships. But don't believe that your prayers or your treatments have any effect upon God. They have an effect upon you. And in proportion as you work with these specific principles, which first of all impersonalize the error, and secondly, nothingize the error, it relieves you of your fear. When you no longer fear germs, weather, climate, food, when you no longer fear bombs, tyrants, when you no longer fear man whose breath is in his nostril, or the conditions of man whose breath is in his nostril, it is only because you have acquired an, what do we call it, an actual communion with God, and you have received within yourself God's assurance that these things are not power. Fear not, they have only the arm of flesh. You have the Lord God Almighty. All might, the only might. Therefore, the enemy of the aliens has no might. If God has all might, these have no might. If God is all might, sin, disease, and death is no might. Therefore, you're not using truth to overcome anything. You are using truth to bring you to the realization that there is no other power to be feared. You need not fear man whose breath is in his nostril, and you need not seek the favor of princes. You need only abide in the realization of Emmanuel, God with us. You need only abide in the realization that all evil has its source out here in a universal belief. Being impersonal, it has no person in whom, on whom, through whom to operate. When you have practiced this for a long enough time, you will find that you have been elevated into a state of consciousness whereby you come into communion with God. And that means you become receptive to the still small voice. You become receptive to the feeling of the presence within. And that's all you need, because where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. And it is for all those who have brought themselves to your consciousness. Do not ever give anyone a treatment. Do not pray for anyone. Forget those who have turned to you for help and turn to the presence of the Father within. And by repeating within yourself, by remembering these specific principles, you will bring yourself to where you no longer fear the appearances that are brought to you. You can't hate error anymore. You can't fear it anymore. Because now you have witnessed that in and of itself, it is not a power. It is merely a belief. So it is that eventually the time comes when you are actually living in the realization of non-power. And that brings you to the highest step in mystical awareness. And you come to it by degrees. When you no longer seek a God power for anything, you are in the highest mystical state of consciousness. When you attain the state of consciousness revealed in the 23rd Psalm, you are in the practitioner teacher state of consciousness, even a step beyond it. When you can truthfully say, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want," then you are in that mystical state. When you no longer turn to God for your supply, but realize, because there is a God, and its nature is love, it is His good pleasure to give me the kingdom, that I don't have to turn to God. I can just rest. The Lord is my shepherd. There's no possibility of my wanting. That is the mystical consciousness. When a claim is presented to you, and you don't run around mentally looking for a God power to do something to that awful condition, then you are approaching the Christ consciousness. The Christ consciousness you can recognize in yourself or another. It doesn't get flustered at problems. It just turns to them and says, what did hinder you? Open your eyes. Lazarus, come forth. No sign of turning to God. No sign of looking for a power to do something to evil. No sign of fearing what these terrible conspirators are going to do to us. Then you are approaching Christ consciousness. For Christ consciousness is a state of consciousness that is rooted and grounded in God as omnipresence, omniscience, omnipotence. And that's all there is, because you don't have to tell the all-knowing anything, and you don't have to use the all-power, because there isn't anything to use an all-power on. There isn't any other power. And there isn't any other presence. If God is law, God must be the only law, so you don't have to worry about a law of matter or a law of mind. These aren't really laws. These are merely beliefs that act as laws in the consciousness of those who still believe in two powers. So it is that in working with these principles, you are developing some measure of Christ consciousness. You are bringing yourself to a state of consciousness in which the appearance of error touches you, and I shall not fear what mortal man can do to me, is your answer. Or, what did hinder you? Come on, get up and start moving. Or, open your eyes. It is a state of consciousness in which you need not reach out to God for anything, for you already have the awareness that God is. And God is my shepherd, and that's why I shall not want. No other reason. God is my shepherd, and that's why I shall not want. God is my life, and therefore it cannot die. God is my mind, and therefore it must be an instrument of intelligence. God is the very substance of my body, and therefore my body must be the temple of God. I don't go to God to have it made so. I work with these principles until I come to the realization that it is so. The whole mistake of prayer is going to God to get God to do something. God is the same forever. From everlasting to everlasting, God is God. God changeth not, and no one can change God. But you can rise above the universal belief of good and evil, and thereby come into actual communion with God. This, of course, is the object of infinite way work. The object is not merely healing or supplying. These are merely evidences of the proof of the principles. The object of our work is to bring your consciousness to that place where you actually commune with God, where you no longer have to say, I believe in God. Those are the saddest words in any language. I believe in God. It really means I don't know anything about it, and I blindly believe. That's a sad state of being. Rise above believing in God and come into the actual experience of communion with God. You won't have any beliefs anymore about God. You have the experience. You have the daily communion. You will have daily conscious realization. There's no more belief about that at all. No more belief at all. It's demonstration. It's reality. reality experience, and it can be attained by those who have been led to the metaphysical teachings. In other words, no one in the metaphysical movements has come of their own accord. They have been either led or driven by the hand of God, very much as Moses reached Egypt the hard way, being thrown in a ditch and sold into slavery. But it got him to Egypt. And most of us have either come to the realization of God through sin, or through disease, or through lack, or through threatened death. And in that way, God has either led us or pushed us into one of the metaphysical teachings. From there on, there is no limit to our demonstration except any limit that we place upon ourselves by inertia, by an unwillingness to really dig in and work until we attain this consciousness. Now, this experience is not possible to the world at large because it hasn't started in the kindergarten of spiritual experience until it is lifted out of orthodoxy. And the only exception to that rule are the few in orthodoxy who, by some grace of God, have been given their inner spiritual release, not by following their church teachings, but in spite of those church teachings. No one can come to the spiritual throne by those church teachings because they are erroneous. As a matter of fact, they are the same pagan teachings that were on earth before Jesus. Every one of the rites and rituals and ceremonies of your modern church were borrowed from the pagans. The rites, ceremonies, and rituals that existed before the Master was born, because please remember this, the Master did not originate any rites, rituals, or ceremonies. He was a Hebrew rabbi, and the only ones he knew were those of the Hebrew church, and he didn't approve of those. And he constantly preached against them. Ye need not worship in this holy mountain or this holy temple in Jerusalem. And man was not made for the Sabbath. Sabbath was made for man. And God has no pleasure in your sacrifices. He was telling the Hebrews over and over again to throw aside those pagan practices and come up and learn what Paul later voiced as, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision availeth anything. What you do or don't do in the way of ceremonies or rites or rituals is of no avail. It is what you do in your consciousness that brings you into the kingdom of God or keeps you out. Going through ceremonies won't get you there. So it is that these ceremonies of the church were not Christian. They were not originated by Jesus Christ. Baptism was practiced by John the Baptist before the days of the Master. And you know what the Master said of baptism? Suffer it to be so now. He didn't say anything about 2,000 years from now. And so forth and so forth and so on. And all the way through, the Master and Paul taught, let go of these paganistic practices and these beliefs that by going through rotes and rituals, that you are enhancing yourself, and do that which is the important thing. Pray in secret. Pray in secret, and the Father that seeth in secret will reward thee openly. Do your alms in secret, not to be seen of men. Do it in secret, and the Father that seeth in secret will reward you openly. Pray without ceasing, forgive 70 times 7, pray for your enemies, pray for those that persecute you, pray for those that despitefully use you, and over again, forgive and forgive and forgive. This is the way to the kingdom of God. that ye may be children of God, pray for your enemies, for it profiteth you nothing to pray for your friends. The Master has told us how to be children of God, and it is not the way of pagan practices. It is the way of inner prayer, inner communion, inner realization, so that you rise to the point where you can say with him, the Father within me, the Father within me, he performeth the works. He doeth all of these things. The I within me is my bread and wine and water. Not rites, rotes, cirits, and ceremonies, and ceremonials, and feast days, and fast days, but I am your bread and your wine. And the recognition that this I in the midst of you is your bread, meat, wine, and water is your inner prayer. And the Father that seeth that in secret rewardeth thee openly. Love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind, and you cannot do it if you believe there is a power which God has to fight or work against. You are only loving God supremely if you acknowledge God's power as the only power. You are not loving God supremely until you understand the word omnipresence. Until you understand that God is the only presence where I am, where you are, where he is, where she is, where it is. Omnipresence. Only in that can you lose your fear of man whose breath is in his nostril, or lose your desire to seek the favor of princes. In the realization of omnipresence, God constitutes individual being, and that's all you recognize. And you recognize mortality as being nothing but an illusion of sense. You don't try to heal it, cure it, or get rid of it. You just recognize it as the nothingness that it is. Then you are loving God supremely. To love thy neighbor as thyself is to know that this is a universal truth. It makes no difference if we're white or black, Jew or Gentile. It makes no difference if we're bond or free. The truth is omnipresence. The truth is omniscience. The truth is omnipotence. And when you abide in that, automatically your consciousness becomes that mind which was also in Christ Jesus, meaning the mind that has no fear of infection or contagion, has no fear of the armies of the aliens, whatever the name, whatever the nature. If you can be made to fear bombs, be assured you'll be somebody's slave sooner or later, because they'll keep threatening it until you do give in. You cannot be free ever while you have fear, whether it's of germs or bombs, whether it's of people or dictators. You can never be free until you have come to the realization, all that God is, I am, for I and the Father are one. Until you come to the realization that, Son, thou art ever with me, all that I have is thine. When you can walk up and down this world singing within yourself, I and the Father are one, and all the Father hath is mine. Right within me is the bread, the meat, the wine, and the water. Right within me is the resurrection, the life eternal. Wherever I go, I carry it. If I mount up to heaven, if I make my bed in hell, if I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, this that is within me goes with me, the Father within me. When you come eventually to this, after you've lived with these words, lived with them, you come to the place where Paul came, when he can say, I live, yet not I. Christ liveth my life. It is an invisible presence that goes before me to make the crooked places straight. It is an invisible presence and power that goes to prepare mansions for me. I do not have to speak outwardly or openly. I know this truth inwardly, secretly, and sacredly. And then the invisible Father that seeth in secret goes before me to reveal the demonstration on the outer plane. You develop this consciousness by the practice of specific principles and working with those principles, whether you take them in through the spoken word or through the oral word, as long as they get in, and then you begin to work with them within you. Remember, you will not make spiritual progress merely by reading books and hearing truth. This is only a stage. It is what you do with truth after it has touched your consciousness that determines the degree of your demonstration. In other words, to say to you, evil, regardless of its name or nature, is not a power. I am voicing truth to you, and because in some measure I have realized this truth, healings take place in this room. That is inevitable. But don't be too exhilarated by that, because you must go and do likewise. You must take these truths and live with them, ponder them, cogitate, meditate. Keep these truths ever alive in your consciousness until one day you find they fall down from here into the heart. And after that, you don't voice them or think them anymore. They're just always there as a realized state of consciousness. That is why he could say that few there be that enter. He told them the truth. And he demonstrated that it was the truth. And then he sorrowfully had to say, if I go not away, the Comforter will not come to you. In other words, all you're doing is relying on my consciousness of truth. You're not taking to heart these principles and working with them until you develop your own Christ consciousness. You're just being sheep. And you're relying on your leader. And that's only good for the infant in truth. Eventually, every student must work with these principles. It doesn't mean that they shouldn't ask for help when they need help. It doesn't mean that at all. It doesn't mean that they must arbitrarily and humanly, with willpower, determine that they'll meet this problem themselves and won't ask help. There's not much virtue in that. It does mean that you work with these principles, that as problems come up, that you work with them and try to meet them yourself. If you do not quickly meet them, turn to someone else for help. But don't rely entirely on that. Be sure always that you are working with these principles until you have developed this consciousness of Christ in some measure. Certainly, you will have to realize that it's only a tiny measure, that it's only a grain. But, oh, what works take place in this world with even a grain of Christ consciousness. And once the first grain has unfolded, the others multiply rapidly. But don't ever be discouraged. And another thing let me tell you. I know that as you go from this class, that many of you go with your heads in the clouds. I know that it is an exhilarating experience. I know because I know what the power and presence of the Spirit does. But don't be surprised and don't be discouraged when in a few days you commence to feel like a human being again. Because that's normal and that's natural. You yourself will be in that state only as long as you let inertia grasp you. If you recognize the fact that it is your turn now to abide in this word and let this word abide in you, then you too will bear fruit richly. But you must abide in the word. You must let the word abide in you. You must pray without ceasing. You must work with these principles until, little by little, you find that whereas a treatment might last 15 minutes or 20 in the beginning, eventually your treatments will take 3 or 4 minutes, and then the time will come when 30 seconds will be much more time than you'll need for an average treatment. It is only in that way that some practitioners have come to the place where they care for 75, 80, 90, 100 patients in a day, only because the treatment does not take place in time or space. It is an activity of consciousness, an activity of realized Christ consciousness. And realized Christ consciousness means your individual consciousness when it no longer fears anything or anybody in the external world. And you have some measure of Christ consciousness from the moment that your fears lessen, because it is only by virtue of the attainment of Christ consciousness that fears can lessen. A human being cannot stop fearing. And therefore, don't ever make the mistake of saying to your patients who are in fear, now please stop fearing. You might just as well tell an alcoholic, just stop drinking alcohol. Don't try it. It isn't good advice. They can't do it anyhow. And your patient can't stop fearing if they're fearing. There's only one way you can stop their fearing. Sit down in the silence until the Spirit of the Lord God is upon you, and they will very quickly let you know that their fears have dissolved. Don't think ever that by talking truth to your patients that you're healing them. Sometimes you're aggravating them. We don't like to hear these truths when we're in trouble, because the first thought comes to us, well, if it's true, why isn't it doing something for me? It's far better not to speak to your patient when they're in real distress, using real distress merely in the sense of distress that they're actually experiencing. It is better to assure them that you are going to give them immediate help. It is better to assure them that you'll continue this help until they are free, and then sit down and get still until you do feel the presence of God, and you'll find how quickly they will respond. Then, when they are no longer in pain or acute distress, then you can begin to impart to them the principles with which you are working. I have found in my own work that I have made very little headway in trying to talk truth to patients when they're in great pain or in great trouble of any kind. And I think that lesson came home to me most forcibly when one of my patients in the old days lost her husband through passing. And I was supposed to say something that would comfort her. Well, I don't know any words in the English language that'll comfort anyone in a case of that kind. I don't believe any words have ever been coined that will ever comfort anyone, really. You can mouth all the words and feel that you've done your part, knowing that it hasn't had much effect. But I learned that we can give comfort. We can lift them above their grief. We can stop their grief by going into the silence and coming into conscious contact with the Christ, the Spirit of God. As we touch that Spirit of God, it releases them from their grief in just the same way that it releases others from fear, others from sin, others from false appetite, others from physical pain. It is the same thing that does the word Christ realized. Not just the word Christ spoken, Christ realized. When you realize the presence within yourself, when through your meditation, when even through your working with these principles, you can lift yourself to a state of consciousness in which all fear has gone, in which a feeling of release has come, believe me, your patient is made free. Then, if they seek something more than just healing, then they can come to you and you can begin to impart these principles to them, slowly giving them the milk of the word and not trying to give them the most advanced metaphysics that you know, because you can't impart it. You can't any more impart a message such as we have had tonight to a beginner than a college professor can impart his mathematics to the grammar school boy. There is no preparedness yet for this message. The things of God are foolishness unto man. And that is one of the things that have helped to make metaphysics seem ridiculous to many people. The fact that so many metaphysicians have gone around to those uninitiated and have made the most absolute statements of truth. Oh, it isn't real. Oh, there are no accidents in divine mind. And you expect somebody out here that's just witnessed a crack up or got a broken bone not to laugh at you, ridicule you, when in their mind there's nothing more real than sin, disease, death, lack, and limitation. It is far better to encourage them to have faith in God and in some principle of freedom than it is to give them these metaphysical cliches and some of the most absolute statements, which are hard enough even for the advanced student to accept unless they are imparted to them by someone who has attained the consciousness. Don't try to impart truth that you haven't, at least in some measure, realized, because all you're doing is trying to mouth words out of a dictionary, and they have no power. Spiritual words only have power when they are spoken with someone who has the consciousness of the meaning of what is being spoken. In other words, when the master says, "What did Hindu you pick up your bed and walk?" be assured that the patient can do it. When the master says, "Open your eyes," be assured they can do it, because behind those words are his consciousness. But don't think you or I can do it until or except in proportion as we have attained the consciousness of what those words mean. Well, students, I really feel that this has been a most wonderful class, an unusual class, and it won't be but a few weeks that these tapes will be in all over the United States and Canada and Africa, England, Holland, Switzerland, all over the Protestant world, because I know what is in this class, and I know that it has value for our students who are advanced or advancing. And believe me, they shall have them. And thank you for this opportunity and this privilege of sharing with you.